If you weren't in San Francisco last month, don't worry, because we're going to bring you top updates from the APA annual meeting. Welcome to the Carlett Psychiatry Podcast, a CME publication keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlett Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a Psych NP student and a dedicated reader of every issue.
I spent some time last month at the American Psychiatric Association meeting in San Francisco, and I bring you some updates from that meeting today from the world of depression, substance abuse, child psychiatry, complementary and alternative medicine, and sleep medicine. I'm just going to bring you a few practical pointers, things that stood out to me as new and useful and potentially practice-changing. First, in depression. The inflammatory theory of depression is gathering steam. It seems that depression is not an inflammatory illness, but that a large subset of depressed patients have inflammation contributing to their problem, about 20 to 30% do. Inflammation is the body's natural defense against invaders and microorganisms and toxins, so it's a good natural response, but when it goes on chronically, it causes depression. And some of the causes of inflammation that you might see in your patients are chronic psychosocial stress, as well as early childhood adversity, insomnia, the Western diet, lack of exercise, obesity, and certain chronic medical illnesses, many of which are inflammatory, particularly chronic infections. But it also turns out you can measure inflammation through the C-reactive protein, which is the most popular biomarker for inflammation. And this is an inexpensive test, around $20 to $40. I spoke with Mark Rappaport, who is the editor of the APA's Focus Journal, about how you might use the C-reactive protein to guide medication selection and the overall care of the patient. Dr. Rappaport, do you think that checking a C-reactive protein to measure levels of inflammation is ready for prime time in clinical practice?
Well, you know, I think we're at a point from all of the meta-analyses and other studies that suggest that it may be wise. And the reason for doing it is the following. If somebody has a higher CRP, the data suggests that they would be more responsive to dopaminergic agents and not responsive to serotonergic agents. If that's the case, we wouldn't want to start that person on an SSRI. And if we did, then what we're doing is using a treatment that may be less effective and subjecting somebody to 6 to 12 weeks of treatment with the wrong agent at the time.
So dopaminergic agents like bupropion?
Yes.
And are there other medications that would have a more favorable response if the CRP was elevated?
Bupropion would be a great one. You could also go off-label and you could use something like pramipexole.
And how would CRP inform lifestyle recommendations we might make for the patient?
I think in general what it would suggest, if somebody's CRP is elevated, that they should consider eating more of a Mediterranean diet, emphasizing foods that are high in omega-3s and low in omega-6. So you don't want to have the French fries. You don't want to have the Burger Kings. You don't want to have the fast food or the fried foods that we frequently have. You want a diet that's rich in vegetables, rich in fruits. You want a diet that's rich in certain types of fatty fish. And that's more likely to help. The other thing that will help is exercise.
How should a clinician order the CRP?
I would suggest that you look for the high sensitivity CRP. There's good data from the CDC and the American Heart Association to suggest that if someone has a CRP of 3 or greater, that they certainly are in an inflammatory range. Now, the meta-analyses that have been done in psychiatry would suggest that even a lower CRP, greater than 1, help indicate individuals that are more likely to respond to these dopaminergic agents. But I certainly would use it in somebody with a 3 or greater.
So a high-sensitivity C-reactive protein greater than 3 and possibly greater than 1 predicts response to dopaminergic agents like bupropion and pramipexole, as well as to nortriptyline. Inflammation has a number of detrimental effects on the brain, but particularly on the dopamine system, which is part of the reason that the speakers are emphasizing dopamine agents, in addition to the clinical studies that are showing a preferential response when patients with inflammation take those medications. We spoke about pramipexole in our June-July issue of 2018. Pramipexole goes by the brand name Mirapex. It's now generic. It was originally developed for Parkinson's disease, later FDA approved for restless leg syndrome. And there's about 3 or 4 controlled trials in bipolar and unipolar depression where it had a large effect. The way that you dose it in mood disorders is to start low with 0.25 milligrams and raise slowly about once a week by 0.25 toward an effective dose, which is usually 1 to 2 milligrams given all at night. The reason you raise it slowly is to avoid nausea, the main side effect, and orthostatic hypotension. It can also cause tiredness and very rarely has been associated with pathological gambling, much as aripiprazole, Abilify, which is another dopamine agonist, has. And for substance use disorders, I went to a seminar called Choosing the Right Treatment for Substance Use Disorders by Drs. Dakwar, Nunez, Basaga, Mariana, and Levin. And the top tip I drew from that was that there's really no effective pharmacotherapy for marijuana use disorders. There are 2 that stand out as having positive trials. That's the CAM treatment. N-acetylcysteine, or NAC, can be taken over-the-counter. The dose is around 2,000 milligrams per day. And gabapentin, Neurontin. But while those 2 have a positive trial, they also have a negative trial. In the case of gabapentin, the negative trial hasn't been published yet. So the glass is half full, half empty with those medications for marijuana abuse. By the way, for gabapentin, the dose used in marijuana abuse is 1,200 milligrams per day. Now, the disappointing findings in marijuana abuse are not for lack of trying. Almost every medication has been tried. Even synthetic analogs of THC, like the prescription medicine Marinol, did not work. People just continued to use and sometimes even used more with Marinol. Now, Trexone, the opioid blocker, has been tried, but in experimental settings, patients actually used more marijuana in the first week after taking naltrexone. That's strange, but then a couple weeks later, they used less marijuana while taking naltrexone, so overall it didn't have much of an effect. Most medications did nothing at all. A few marijuana seemed to increase on them, such as quetiapine, Seroquel. Even though it helped mood, people used more marijuana on it, and venlafaxine, Effexor. This next finding surprised me, given all the attention that buprenorphine Suboxone gets for opioid use disorders, that methadone actually has a higher retention rate in the clinics than Suboxone. The retention rates are 75% with methadone, but only 50% with buprenorphine Suboxone. They also shared a practical tip for using naltrexone, the opioid antagonist, in patients with opioid dependence. Naltrexone is FDA approved in this population because it helps people maintain sobriety, but it can't be started right away if the patient's used opioids recently because it'll precipitate a withdrawal state. So the question is, how long do you have to wait? And what they recommend is the patient should be opioid free for 7 to 10 days before starting naltrexone. Dr. David Michelon, who was one of the authors on the APA textbook on complementary and alternative medicine, hosted a conference on that subject. There was a lot to learn, but I'll just give you one tidbit. He mentioned that omega-3 fatty acids are the most popular over-the-counter CAM therapy used in America. So a lot of patients are taking it, and it does have reasonable evidence in depression and bipolar disorder, as well as a host of other populations like borderline personality disorder, nonspecific irritability, and autism. And while omega-3s are generally good for health and in large part are risk-free, there is one risk to look out for in your patients is that they should stop it 1 to 2 weeks before undergoing surgery because omega-3s can increase bleed time. But they should start it back right after surgery. And the reason for that is that there is evidence of better wound healing when patients take omega-3s, perhaps because of their antioxidant effects. Dr. Michelon also recommended that the dose should be 1 to 3 grams a day, and he recommended not going above 3 grams a day which is 3,000 milligrams, because you can have an increased risk of bleeding. For more on omega-3 with specific product and dosage recommendations, look back to our last podcast, where we discussed its use in early phases of psychosis and mood disorders, called Ginger Ale and Normal Hallucinations. Well, I didn't quite fit all the highlights in, but I'll be back in a couple weeks with more from the APA meeting, including tips on managing mood disorders in children and some novel approaches to sleep medications. Send us your questions to asktheeditor@thecarletreport.com. And if you like this podcast, think about subscribing. We have a special offer for podcast listeners. You get $30 off your first year's subscription with the promo code podcast@thecarletreport.com.
The subscription includes the print edition delivered to your mailbox and full access to all the articles on the website, monthly CME credits to maintain licensure, as well as an option for self-assessment credits toward your board certification.
The Carlet Report is one of few CME publications that's funded entirely by our subscribers, and that helps us stay free of the pharmaceutical industry's influence and bring you information you can trust.